From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, is the cash bail system unfair and unconstitutional? Charges of corruption in the building of the border fence, what does that mean for the border wall? And life in a border colonia, third world conditions in the United States. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. A civil rights group is urging Harris County judges to get in line with the federal court ruling that found the bail system unconstitutional. Some county officials say the district court's order creates a public safety risk, but others say it penalizes those who can't afford bonds. From Houston Public Media, Ed Mayberry reports.
Last June, U.S. District Judge Lee Rosenthal ordered most indigent misdemeanor defendants who were denied personal bonds to be released from jail on unsecured bonds within 24 hours. Harris County has spent more than $5 million appealing a federal lawsuit challenging its bail system. Another bail reform effort is underway in Dallas. Cynthia Cole with the Greater Houston Coalition for Justice says Sandra Blam didn't have $500 for her bond.
Should the bail bondsman system represent individuals who have minimal amount of money, so you stay in, and someone who does have money just gets out and walks. We're asking these judges to please readdress the issue.
Representative Carol Alvarado of Houston says the issue will be discussed at the state level.
As we go back to the legislature next session, we will be working to make sure that we can address this civil rights violation affecting minority populations.
Two sitting judges have opted out of the appeal to Judge Rosenthal's ruling, but 14 others are waiting to hear from the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. In Houston, I'm Ed Mayberry.
The civil rights organization, the Texas Fair Defense Project, has joined in the lawsuit seeking to do away with the cash bail system. The Texas Fair Defense Project's mission is to fight for a criminal justice system that respects the rights of low-income Texans. Suzanne Pringle is the executive director.
We, along with the Co-Counsel Civil Rights Corps and ACLU nationally in Texas, and ACLU of Texas, filed a lawsuit last Sunday challenging the money bail practices in Dallas County as unfair and unconstitutional. And in Harris County, there's still a preliminary injunction standing, which requires the courts to release folks after 24 hours on an amount of bail that they can afford to pay, rather than holding them on money amounts of bail that they cannot afford to pay.
How do we end up with the system we have now?
I think we've ended up with the system we have now because counties have gotten used to using the money bail system as effectively a preventative detention system out of fear. And there's a lot of evidence that shows that communities are actually safer when people who should be released on should be released pretrial so that they can actually fight their cases and continue to be parts of their community when all that has happened is that they've been alleged to have committed a crime. There's a lot of evidence that communities are safer when people are actually able to remain in the community and fight their case.
These are people who haven't been convicted of anything yet. They are a pretrial prisoner. In order to get out of jail, and they have to pay a certain amount of money to ensure that they'll show up on the court date. And so, but there are plenty of people out there that when they get assessed thousands of dollars of bail, they don't have the means to pay it, even with a bail bond, and then they end up just staying around in jail and costing the county a lot of money. So is that the observation?
It's unfair to people. It's unconstitutional. It ruins the lives of people who can't afford to purchase their freedom and the lives of their family members who don't have their family member home with them, providing care, providing financial support, et cetera. It is also even more costly to the county to be holding these people in jail pretrial than it would be to release them. Let's say there's two people. One has money, one doesn't, and they're both arrested for trespass, right? And the bail schedule says, for example, $500 for trespass. The person with the $500 would immediately be released because they paid $500. The person without the $500 could be held for days and weeks. And often, you know, those people who are held on bail that they cannot afford end up pleading guilty to get out of jail.
Now, they have PR bonds, personal recognizance bonds. Isn't that supposed to be used in circumstances where a person has a job, they have a great record, and it seems like, yeah, we can let this person out and not have to take up another bed in a county jail.
Personal recognizance bonds are certainly an option. They can help get people released. The issue is what's happening at the beginning, which is these charge-based offenses. Bail amounts, right? So if you have a bail schedule, as you do in Dallas County, where different offenses have been pre-assigned money amounts, and different offenses have been pre-assigned whether or not the judges will even consider a personal recognizance bond, that means that the judges aren't ever doing an individualized determination, as they're supposed to under the Constitution, or an individualized determination of the ability to pay for each of these people. They're doing offense-based money amounts as opposed to risk-based assessments. One question is, how do you get people back in court? And there are a variety of low-cost methods that other jurisdictions have started using, for example, text message reminders, vouchers for cabs and buses that get people back in court. So there are a number of different low-cost mechanisms that have been proven to be useful and to get people back into court. In terms of how the court should be determining who can be released pretrial and who can't be released pretrial, I mean, we certainly think that pretrial release should be the norm rather than the exception, and that's what the Constitution requires. There are some validated pretrial risk assessments that give you some, that can give you an unbiased assessment as to whether or not someone is at high risk of failing to appear or coming back into court. But really, the issue here is that Dallas County and other courts or other court systems are using the money bail as a preventative detention system.
Suzanne Pringle is the executive director of the Texas Fair Defense Project. They are part of a coalition of civil rights organizations and reformers seeking to end the cash bail system. As the nation debates the merits and the $25 billion cost of a massive wall along the U.S. southern border, new information is coming to light about how business was conducted during the construction of the President George W. Bush era border fence. The Texas Tribune and ProPublica are reporting on charges of corruption and kickbacks and self-dealing that funneled millions of taxpayer dollars to one official in Hidalgo County. Kia Collier is a reporter and editor for the Texas Tribune.
Hidalgo County is currently suing a former employee that oversaw the construction of this sort of strange hybrid border fence levee wall that was constructed in partnership with Homeland Security about a decade ago. And they're alleging that he got a commission on the project that he shouldn't have gotten, and that his family got work on the project, his family's company, a company owned by his two sons, and that he should have disclosed that to both the county and Homeland Security, and that he didn't do that. And he doesn't really deny any of these allegations, but he says they were all approved by county commissioners and, you know, it was all done essentially above board. Everything was approved by Hidalgo County commissioners who double as the Hidalgo County Drainage District, which oversaw this levee fence project.
So the person at the center of all this is Godfrey Garza Jr. He's the former director of the county's Drainage District. And the reason why that's significant is because they put the border fence, and it's a huge structure. It's like the border wall. But they went on top of the levees, and they also used it as an opportunity to do some work on the drainage area, which is very important because we call the Rio Grande Valley a valley, but actually it's a delta, and there's a lot of drainage issues.
That's right, yeah. There were these crumbling kind of dirt levees along the Rio Grande. They're already owned by the federal government, the International Boundary and Water Commission. And so Hidalgo County was looking at, you know, beginning to repair those levees before, you know, the border fence even was a thing. And so it was viewed as kind of this win-win, and that Homeland Security would, you know, shore up these crumbling levees, and it would double as, you know, a border barrier to keep out both drug smugglers and floodwaters from the Rio Grande.
But so this was at a time when we were not talking about $25 billion border wall that would go from Brownsville to San Diego or even Brownsville to Laredo. but it was in spots. But now things are at a much bigger scale, and it's this lawsuit that we're seeing as the county, Hidalgo County, is trying to recover some funds that they think that they need to get from Godfrey Garza Jr., that we're able to pull back the veil a little bit and see how some things about how that fence was built and how the land was acquired. We're learning more about what happened at that time, and hopefully that means that will tell us something about what could be happening in the future. Is that why this is significant?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, it was a massive undertaking then, and what's under discussion now is even more massive. A big factor under the Bush administration was Congress set this deadline of December 31st, 2008, to build 700 miles of fence along the U.S.-Mexico border. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Homeland Security, Customs and Border Protection, they were racing essentially to get this project done in kind of record time, and they cut a lot of corners in terms of acquiring land. And in the instance of this project in Hidalgo County, they sort of appeared to just drop a check in the local bank and say, we don't really care how you get it done as long as you get it done on time.
Oversight, and how much will there be in the legal protections for private landowners who will see eminent domain lawsuits filed against them as we try to build more border wall, and also in construction with $25 billion on the line. There will be a gold rush to see who gets contracts to build the wall, and whether or not these are going to be done on a merit basis, or if there'll be more kickback schemes, which is the allegation which happened in Hidalgo County. But they say that Godfrey Garza Jr. was able to get $3.5 million in kickbacks. That's the allegation, right?
So that would be just the commission. So he, before the border fence was even a discussion, there's sort of a series of steps that set him up to become a millionaire off of this project. And one, which is questionable kind of at the local level, is he negotiated this contract with county commissioners that would give him a 1.5% cut of construction costs on certain drainage projects. And their argument in this lawsuit is that the federal, levee fence project was not among the projects he should have gotten a commission on. And yet he, still told the chief financial officer that, she was supposed to write him a check for that commission on the project. They're saying, he outright was not entitled to that. I think it's $3.7 million. And then in addition to that, Valley Data Collection Specialist, the company that was owned at the time by his sons, got, at least $1.5 million in work from contractors on the project. I understand it's probably a whole lot more than that. And yet no one knew formally that they were, that company was working on the project at all. And in new filings, the county is basically claiming that Godfrey Garza, sat down with engineering contractors and said, I will recommend that the county give you this contract if you agree to hire my family's company. And that would be, the kickback scheme alleged in this new filing.
One of the big concerns is that when you have public officials who are personally profiting from the construction of things like a border wall, you have to wonder about whose interest they are acting in. Are they going to be doing things to gain over $3 million for their own personal bank account? Or are they going to be working on behalf of the people, and whether or not they're going to be getting the best bang for their buck?
I see the construction of, a border wall or a border fence as kind of a win-win for Republicans in general, because they are both appeasing their base and, potentially creating wealth, generating jobs by, having this massive, public works project that involves, billions in contracts, and that will benefit, a lot of local companies, and these large, companies like Boeing that are, I don't know if there's a conference of, you know, border security or homeland security kind of contractors that convenes every year, and that took place, I think, this week. And they get together, and of course they're just, you know, excited by the prospect of getting to work on something like this. So, you know, it's no secret that contractors are salivating over the potential of, you know, working on something like this. And it would make them a lot of money.
Kia Collier is a reporter and editor for the Texas Tribune. With ProPublica, they are reporting on charges of corruption connected to the border fence construction, which is the forerunner of the now-debated Trump border wall. In the political fight over the border wall, DACA recipients face a painful choice. Should they support President Donald Trump's offer of an immigration deal if it means agreeing to funding the wall? DACA stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. That's the Obama-era program that granted temporary residency for Dreamers, who, as children, were brought into the country without authorization. Trump says Congress needs to come up with a permanent fix for DACA, but some of the Dreamers in South Texas told me they won't support the border wall, even if it means they gain a pathway to citizenship. 75 years ago, the Santa Ana National Wildlife Refuge was established along the Rio Grande. But on Saturday, outside the gates to the 2,000-acre nature area, a crowd of supporters wasn't having a birthday party. It was holding a protest. Hundreds of people turned out, trying to preserve the preserve from the border wall. Scott Nickel of the Sierra Club says this is ground zero for Trump's border barrier.
The first of those walls would hit Santa Ana National Wildlife Refuge.
The federal government could move fast to wall off the refuge because it already owns the land. Most other property along the Texas-Mexico border is privately owned, and eminent domain land grabs take time. Nichols says the only thing that's stopping the wall from being built at the Santa Ana right now is money. Congress needs to approve it. Trump wants that done the next time legislators meet to fund the government, expected on February 8th.
Everybody here is basically saying no, they should not give them the money for the wall.
To make that point, many protesters wore T-shirts that read, Save Santa Ana, or No Border Wall. Four protesters operated a giant puppet portraying an ocelot, the wildcat that lives in the area. Erica Davila dressed up as the border wall itself.
I just wanted to make people aware so you can see what can happen.
This isn't what Trump intended during those campaign chants.
Build that wall! Build that wall! Build that wall! Build that wall!
Part of the chant included a pledge that Mexico would pay for it.
Who's going to pay for the wall? 100%.
But now Trump wants Congress to spend $25 billion for the barrier. That's going to require votes from Democrats, and in exchange, Trump is promising to pass a DREAM Act with a pathway to citizenship. Here's how Representative Luis Gutierrez, a Chicago Democrat, reacted to that proposal on CNN.
If that's what it's going to take 800,000 young men and women and give them a chance to live freely and openly in America, then I'll roll up my sleeves. I'll go down there with bricks and mortar and begin the walk.
DACA recipient Allison Duarte calls that response by Democrats a stab in the back.
No. No, no deal. No deal.
25-year-old Duarte, a native of Mexico, came to the United States when she was 13. Duarte, her mother, and her brother crossed the Rio Grande in the pre-dawn hours and set out to build a new life.
So in our case, it was, you know, just looking for better economic opportunities. We struggled quite a bit back home.
Life in the United States was also hard.
Obviously, if you're not documented, usually you find the lowest kind of employment. Oftentimes, there's abuse.
But in the United States, there's also a promise.
They always push this narrative of, if you work hard, it's going to pay off. The American dream. And you start to believe in.
After graduating from high school, Duarte was offered soccer scholarships around the country, but she couldn't accept them because of her undocumented immigration status. She studied philosophy at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley, and graduated. Her younger brother, Chris, also a DACA recipient, recently graduated with a degree in computer science. Both of their lives would immediately improve if a DREAM Act deal is reached, but she says she doesn't want that.
I cannot be so selfish, forget about other immigrant groups, my parents, and just community members that will be affected by an actual physical border wall.
Supporters of the border wall argue that it is needed to improve national security, combat the flow of drugs, and end illegal immigration. Opponents like Duarte says the wall will do none of those things, and that it has become an abstract talking point for politicians. She says with a $25 billion price tag, it deserves a full policy debate and should not be treated as a throwaway bargaining chip when talking about the Dreamers.
I'm not willing to sacrifice that for a potential citizenship that will be granted to me in 10 to 12 years.
Duarte says it's time for Congress to vote on a clean DREAM Act, no strings and no wall attached. In the Rio Grande Valley, David Martin Davies, Texas Public Radio News. The construction of the border wall also means some people who live near the Rio Grande River will lose their homes. And some of these people live in colonias. Washington Post reporter Maria Sacchetti recently wrote about third world-like conditions in South Texas colonias.
Colonia is often the name used in Spanish for neighborhood or barrio. In this case, they're unincorporated areas where people settled. They couldn't at the time perhaps afford to live in more established cities, and they paid for plots of land, and they put down trailers or built their own houses. And unfortunately, in many cases, they were defrauded, and they bought land expecting that services like water and sewer and all the other things you take for granted in cities and even small towns would arrive, and they never did for many, many people.
So there are people who are landowners and they have a tract of land, multi-acres, near cities like Laredo, where you write about, and then they illegally sell off these chunks of land. They're supposed to have them platted by the county and provide services like a sewer and water hookups. But instead, they don't even do that. They just sort of sell off little parcels of land. They don't even get them, give them an actual title to these properties because they were never properly platted.
The issue for Texas is that, and other states, I imagine, but definitely for Texas, is that these colonias began before the laws caught up with them. So a lot of what happened with the colonias is the government invested, millions and millions of dollars to bring them up to code, so to speak. They did provide water or did provide electrical hookups or things like that to improve the colonias. And when we were down there, they were also working to smooth out the roads, which can get really muddy and impassable when it rains. There were healthcare services. There have been investments in colonias, and a lot of them are better than they used to be, but they're still in really serious conditions. There's thousands and thousands of people, including what really struck me are military veterans and others who, go off to serve. Risk their lives to serve the country overseas and then come back. And, they have to live in a place where they don't have water. It's really, it was incredible to talk to them. And I think another misconception is that, these folks are immigrants. And one argument is that, nobody deserves to reside this way, including immigrants and all other residents. But in this particular case, the majority of these folks are Americans. And as you can see from some of the photos, they're Americans who also celebrate the United States. I mean, there are American flags, in this colonia we visited. We were down there last year on the 4th of July, and the entire community center was decked out for the holiday in patriotic colors. So they're Americans, and they're living in these conditions.
Conditions that include typically no running water, no drainage, no sewers, and unpaved roads. And we think about 500,000 people along the U.S.-Mexico border are living in colonias. Is that right?
Right. I mean, not all of them are in that severe situation. There are people with electricity and water in colonias because improvements have been made in those areas. But perhaps they're concerned that their water is contaminated. That's a real that has been a real problem for people in other parts of Texas. The one we visited, it's actually very close to El Cenizo, which has been in the news for mounting a legal challenge to the new Texas law that would crack down on sanctuary cities. And it's extremely close to Laredo. You know, it's just right outside. That's one of the examples of colonias where they really are in extreme conditions. And they also, if your land isn't properly platted, you know, that is registered with the county and deeded and, you know, kind of having the boundaries set, then you can't get electricity.
So you mentioned El Cenizo. El Cenizo is now an incorporated town, but it started out as a colonia, an illegal subdivision.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and that's a town that is still, you know, very poor and has some housing that's in bad condition, but it has definitely improved. I mean, they have a library, they have more services, food pantry, and of course, you know, they have more power, right? So, I mean, you have a mayor who filed this lawsuit and has been able to challenge this law.
So, Texas Governor Greg Abbott. He recently eliminated funding $860,000 that went to a ombudsman who tried to bring improved services to colonias. Can you talk about that?
The Associated Press later reported, and we have that in our story, that that was part of other kinds of cuts that are harder to track, you know, that inside different agencies. So I think it's even more than that, that the colonias lost. The issue being the Secretary of State's office had this program, this ombudsman, these folks who posted their phone numbers online, and their jobs were to serve as a point of contact for people who, you know, and if a colonia needed streetlights or if the colonia's roads kept flooding or if there's something, it was a way to coordinate in a very large state, you know, all these different agencies and the services they might need. People said getting rid of that program was a real loss for people in colonias and made it harder to imagine if you had to call only one place to try to get services. Now you have to call a multitude of different agencies to try to get some help. So that's an issue. But I think, you know, talking to people, the bigger issue goes way beyond the 860,000. The issue is, you know, bottom line, these folks are majority Americans. It's one of the largest concentrations of poverty in the United States. They don't have, in many cases, water, electricity, just basic services. And what one official said is that they should, you know, invest, the state, federal government should invest hundreds of millions of dollars to bring these folks up to code and to make sure that they have the services they need. You know, they bought the land at a time for the most part, when these laws didn't exist, you know, outlawing colonias. And those perhaps who violated the law afterward, maybe they would be dealt with differently, but these folks in particular, you know, they were defrauded in many cases, or they believed that water and sewer and all those other things would arrive, and they didn't. And now, Texas is stuck with this problem.
Maria Sacchetti is an immigration reporter for The Washington Post. She recently covered the extreme poverty conditions of South Texas colonias along the Texas-Mexico border. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also comment on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to. And you can find us wherever you get your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.